It was an unlucky day, you know, bad timing. But I'll tell you, that first day in the hospital, your mother and I stood side by side while most doctors reported to us. And most of the news was bad, but still, we stood there together, we took it together. And then Ola lied. God, Ola told your mother that we'd been having affairs in the past. Okay, there was only that one time. I tried to explain to your mother exactly how it happened to you. You know what your mother said to me? I don't want you around anymore.
Welcome to Now Playing's patron-exclusive review of Shortcuts, a review picked by patron Simon Brennan.
Fish now, or deal with the body.
I say fish now.
Hosted by Stuart. Justin.
Are you cheating, Roth?
No, Marion. You cheat, remember?
And Jacob.
It wouldn't be a trip if Alex Trebek bought a nude painting of me.
But be warned, this episode will contain detailed plot spoilers and strong language.
Yeah, I don't really give a fuck about fish. I just kind of swim and shit.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Marion, I'm giving you a chance to come clean. Clear the slate. On to a higher consciousness. And then don't ever lie to me again, Marion.
This is not like you, Ralph.
What? To demand you're right, Marion, but I want to know. I want to know the truth.
We're just talking, right?
Yes, Marion, we're just talking!
You want me to tell you the truth?
That's all I've ever asked, Marion.
Okay. Kiss me.
Today, we are discussing Shortcuts, starring...
Everybody!
No shortcut around this!
The 1990s!
Starring, in no particular order or no particular amount of importance, Andy McDowell, Julianne Moore, Tim Robbins, Bruce Davidson, Jack Lemmon, Anne Archer, Matthew Modine, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Fred Ward, Chris Penn, Lily Tyler, Robert Downey Jr., Madeline Stowe, Lily Tomlin, and more. We could go on.
Come on, Tom Waits. You got to get Tom Waits in there.
And Tom Waits.
Playing a drunk. Imagine that.
Directed by Robert Altman. I am the podcast host who is one of the only people that's not on this IMDb page, Justin.
And I'm your rugged outdoorsman, Stuart.
And this is the co-host who thinks it would be a real trip if Alex Trebek bought a nude painting of me. Jacob, Alex Trebek, that's another name on that cast list.
Yeah, it's true. The Jeopardy host is here. Everyone is here. You guys are here because you're November patrons. Thank you so much. Why are we rewarding you with a, I don't want to use the word obscure, but maybe hard to obtain movie from 1993? It was requested by one of you, Simon Brennan. Donated specifically so that we would talk about Shortcuts. Do you guys know this movie?
I do not. I know Robert Altman. I've seen Popeye. I've seen MASH, which is nigh incomprehensible, even though I love that book. I've seen The Long Goodbye, which is super awesome. Watch that one. So I know the director and what to expect from him. Mm-hmm. But no, I had never even heard of this one. I thought he was done by 93.
He was, but he came back. We'll talk about it.
Yeah, he did have a comeback. I have seen this before. Must have seen it in college, right around the time it came out, because we were kind of these hoity-toity art school kids, and so we had Laserdisc players in our dorm rooms. So we went to the Laserdisc rental place, And of course, they had a poster up for this. And it was, you know, one of those things that grabbed our eyes because it's like, oh my God, everybody's in it. Huey Lewis is in this movie. We've got to see this.
That's actually one of my memories of seeing it in theaters was Huey Lewis's penis is in this movie.
Yes, you see his full news.
But yeah, I'll tell you what, having seen it that many years ago, only bits and pieces have stuck with me. On this rewatch, I was surprised by how much I did not remember about this movie.
Like you, Jacob, I know Robert Altman. We'll talk about what Robert Altman means now. I think he is an artist that kind of lived in obscurity. Obviously, Hollywood embraced him. This cast is overloading with A-list talent that worked on the cheap just to be a part of his production. And that's true of most of the movies, the 35 films he made throughout his career. But I don't think he is celebrated, certainly now, for what he inspired and what he did. But Simon Brennan donated to hear us talk about Shortcuts because he called it the best film of the 1990s and said that it actually gets overshadowed by Pulp Fiction, Schindler's List, which came out the same year and won Best Picture. And this is his quote, the fanciful Magnolia, which I think is obviously one of the many movies inspired by Shortcuts.
I love Magnolia, and I could not believe as I was watching this for the first time ever, I'm like, oh, like, especially when we get to the end. Yes, definitely borrowed by Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, we'll talk about the influence, but just to wrap up what Simon said, he said it's refreshing to see stories about working class residents of Los Angeles rather than police thrillers or rich people living in Beverly Hills. Gotta agree with that. You're definitely going to get a unique take on life in LA that is not often promoted. And he thinks Robert Altman is just doing an expert job of doing what Robert Altman does, which is juggling a whole lot of storylines in a way that, I don't know, can either feel like jazz or a huge mess.
Oh yeah, the overlapping dialogue. Yeah, it feels like there's some kind of naturalism he's going for. But yeah, I get the jokes too that people make about him, about the huge cast and about how you can't hear things at times. He definitely has a style.
Is he a director or just the MC at an orgy? I don't know. It's sometimes, in his worst examples of movie making, I do think that they just look awful and directionless. And it just feels like everything and nothing happening all at once. But what I think he is famous for is to be able to, yes, synergize these large casts, these multiple storylines of characters that overlap because they all come together to be in a certain location or a certain event, and the camera becomes this fly on the wall. And you as an audience member can kind of choose to find what you find interesting in it. Again, because of overlapping dialogue, sometimes you can't even tell what people are saying. You have to decide what you find interesting in these big tableaus. And yeah, it can be exhausting. It can be rewarding. It can be a really interactive experience to watch a Robert Altman film. And he's worked in so many different genres since the late 60s, all the way up to, I think his last film was in the mid 2000s. He was just always working on these complicated, intricate ensemble films in all kinds of genres. And you've named some of the big ones, Jacob. I think the one that people know about the most, mostly for the TV show, I don't think for the movie, but MASH.
Yeah, I love that book, MASH. Great TV show, that movie. I read the book, could not follow it, could not understand it. And maybe that's the point. It's supposed to be sheer chaos. I get that. But yeah, that's not what made that property popular.
Yeah, I don't like MASH. I'm just going to put it out there. I don't think that's one of Robert Altman's better films, even though it's probably the one people at least have heard the title of. My personal favorite is McCabe and Mrs. Miller. It's a Western with Warren Beatty and Julie Christie that has Leonard Cohen songs and lots of heroin and just, I can't get into it, but it's a very unique take on the Western with Sears and Roebuck as the villains. Worth checking out. Nashville. I don't know if you know that one. That one was up for Best Picture in 75.
That seems to like to be the big one that I haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
It has a lot of the characters that are in this, like Lily Tomlin had her breakout in that movie. Altman tends to work with the same people again and again, and it's definitely one of those that has 40 people all attending a music festival in Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, Nashville seems to be the fan favorite if you're an Altman fan, and I think the one that most people, if you're just kind of a standard moviegoer, not really paying attention to that type of thing, I think most people have heard of The Player, which was pretty much his comeback movie, the mid to late 80s comeback movie, put him back on the map.
Yes. See, this is the thing. So Robert Altman in the 70s is making all of these wild films and sometimes they're hits and always bringing in A-list talent. And then he, you know, makes Popeye. Let's just talk about it. I always thought this would be the first Robert Altman movie and maybe the only Robert Altman movie we'd ever talk about. But that gross cartoon character that I never liked became a gross, unwatchable musical with Robin Williams.
Yeah, with those awful biceps that they molded onto him.
Yeah. Really, I found it so horrifying when that movie came out in theaters. Our choice was Flash Gordon or that, and I was like, neither. It's scary to me. I don't know. I haven't gone back to watch Popeye. I'm not here to judge it now. I'm just saying, as a children's entertainer, Altman didn't have it in 1980, and he blew a lot of Hollywood money. And he spent a decade in obscurity, making TV movies and foreign films, and he didn't get to work in the same way that he did before. He makes this movie called The Player, which is a hate letter to Hollywood. It essentially, Tim Robbins is playing a studio exec who literally gets away with murder and does all these terrible things, and it has this all-star cast coming in showing that celebrities are assholes. Maybe this is not such a surprise in the day of reality TV, but at the time it was considered shocking and really a middle finger to Hollywood, and the surprise was Hollywood loved it. And it became this, yeah, celebrated. It was a little movie. I don't feel like it was a big hit, but it was a big enough phenomenon. It made enough ripples in L.A. that people were like, let's fund this guy's next project. It's been a while since we worked with Altman, and Shortcuts is what he's able to finance out of the success of The Player.
That must have been really successful then, because I don't see how. Well, it was still the 90s. Studios still took a risk, but like, yeah, how do you get financing? We need a million actors from Hollywood and nonlinear storytelling going all over the place.
Well, here's the crazy thing. I agree with you. This feels like a production that would require a lot. It cost $12 million. Everybody worked for scale, and the way that they did it was we can only work with a small batch of actors for a week at a time. So they were only paid for a week's worth of work. I want to say they started with the Andy McDowell storyline. And then they shot for, I think, 2 to 3 months. Every week we get the new actors and they do their bits. And maybe we do some of the crossover stuff. But this thing mostly took a long time in the editing room. To film it, it was about 2 months of work and done, I don't know, relatively cheap. $12 million is a lot less than Popeye. Let me just put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, we're not talking any big sets or special effects or anything. This is all on location, practical sets and all that good stuff. So
they had to get some helicopters.
Yeah, that might have been real.
Oh, it was. One thing that's worth bringing up, what Altman wanted to do that really hadn't been done on screen before, was bring the work of Raymond Carver to life. Now, this name, I thought I knew who the author was that he was adapting, and I realized way late that I was thinking of the guy that wrote The Maltese Falcon, Raymond Chandler, you know, like detective noir fiction. Not him. Do you guys know Raymond Carver? Does that mean anything to you?
Nope, absolutely not.
I did have a little phase where I was really into Bukowski. And Carver's, I wouldn't compare them, but they're adjacent, you know, kind of in their tone and their subject matter. So, yeah, I read a little bit of Carver back in the day, but it was more Bukowski stuff that I was interested in. But, yeah, I mean, getting into this movie and seeing some of these stories, I feel like I might go back and read some of his stuff. It might be more poignant from a middle-aged point of view rather than an angsty teenager reading this stuff.
I picked it up because, obviously, whenever we're watching adapted works, I want to know where they come from. So, yeah, Raymond Carver, just for those that don't know, like me, I guess had a long career throughout the 60s, the 1970s. He died in the late 80s. He is a chronicler of blue-collar life in Portland and Seattle and the Pacific Northwest. He was from that area. He grew up around that kind of burned out, low-paying jobs, bad marriages, alcoholism. Yeah, it was all sort of Seattle before Nirvana kind of vibe. And he captured that in short stories. Everything that he wrote was a short story. He never made time to write a novel. He had 10 books of collected short stories. And most of these stories are, when I say short, I mean like you turn the page and it's over. One or two pages. It's just an impressionistic little moment that he captures between people, sad little, I wouldn't even call them stories, but sad little epiphanies that happen between these lonely, desperate people. It's a very spare prose. It's a very short way of trying to capture America. But I guess literary criticism, and I think you're right, counterculture people discovered him and really celebrate him as one of the best short story writers our country has produced.
And do characters ever cross over, kind of like the storylines we'll talk about, or are they always separate?
No. And that's the thing that was the dream of Altman, was like, what if instead of adapting these, we try to create a world where they all exist and blend? That's the Altman way, is to take storylines and see them fuse. I always feel like if you were to make a movie just about one storyline in a Robert Altman movie, wouldn't be a very good movie. It's about putting them all together that creates that epic quality. All his idea to do that. And because Carver was dead, here's the funny thing. A lot of his best work was already purchased and bought up by other people. Altman couldn't get the rights to the stories he actually wanted to make. And Shortcuts is populated with leftovers. All the stories that he had to work with, it wasn't like he assembled them saying, these will all tell a great story together. It was like, well, nobody bought this. I guess we'll just put it in with the rest of them. And so this is 10 short stories from taken all throughout different periods of Carver's life. But I really want to stress this. Changed and adapted a lot of improvisation. I think the actors really creates whole new storylines. In many cases, I read all 10 of the stories that supposedly inspired these stories. And in many cases, maybe only in one or two, do they actually follow what happens on the page.
Yeah, I mean, according to Carver's widow, she was saying that she was proud that someone like Altman was taking this work and giving it new life. She basically said that there's just as much Altman as there is Carver in Shortcuts, if not more.
Yeah, and just want to put it that the fact that we're talking about a story that's taking place in L.A., even if it's working class L.A., L.A. was not a place that Carver covered. He covered, again, small town Pacific Northwest. If you want to talk about Portland, Oregon, if you want to talk about Seattle or that kind of seedy, low-class area, that was his milieu. To go to L.A. is definitely the Altman inspiration.
And was this movie Tinseltown's world? Like, Simon, who donated for this, you know, he's saying best film of the 90s. It's certainly not remembered like that, I don't think. I don't know if most people associate this one with the 90s, unless maybe they saw it.
Well, I mean, again, looking at the Oscars for that year, it was the Schindler's List year. Spielberg took it all, and The Piano was up for a lot of things as well.
Did this get nominations?
It didn't really even get nominated for much. Altman got nominated for Best Director and, of course, lost to Steven Spielberg, but not a Best Picture. I think there were too many actors to be singled out as...
They're all supporting.
Yeah, they're all supporting, and they would take up all the categories. So I think, in the end, you're right, this movie flopped. Let's just call it an ugly word. It cost $12 million, but it only made $6 million. For all the critical love, it just couldn't, at 3 hours length, a lot of people back in 1993 would not sit down for a three-hour movie. And it was considered an art film at a time when that was a very specialty market. And so, yeah, I do think that a lot of people, if it had gotten the Oscar nominations, people would have discovered it. It got the Independent Spirit Award that year for Best Picture, which is essentially like throwing a message in a bottle and out into the Pacific Ocean. Maybe you'll define it, but probably not. And I do think the way that this movie has lived on and the way that people remember it is through all the imitators, all the people that tried to tell similar ensemble stories. And it's true, Pulp Fiction, while it came out the next year, I do think there is Altman connections within that world. I do think that Robert Altman's 70s movies had an influence. I do think Slacker, some of the Richard Linklater movies of the 1990s, Dazed and Confused, very Altman inspired. And of course, Magnolia. Ironically, 2005 Crash wins Best Picture, and I think it owes an incredible debt to this film.
Well, that's what worried me when I was like, oh, we're doing this Altman film with all these storylines, and there's movies like Crash or Babel or I believe even Traffic, where these big ensembles, and they seem like they're all distant characters, but they're all going to intertwine and give us a nice little message, and that really bothers me. And perhaps that's why I prefer Magnolia, because it's more about the chaos, and is there any coincidence in this? Who knows? But because of the imitators, I was worried putting this on. Would that live up to the worst cliches that I felt these kind of films do?
Yeah, halfway through this film, you're wondering, like, okay, is there going to be a huge coincidence and everybody is in the same place at the same time and wraps this up and makes this whole thing a little bit of a cheeseball experience?
I mean, for this show, just to help me out, and I did send it to my fellow co-host, but I mapped out all these characters. How do they connect? Are there ones that never meet? Yeah, it is a big map of what do all these different lives mean and how do they come together, if they come together.
I'll tell you this. It would have been nice if there was more crossover for the plot summary. This one was rough.
Yeah, I guess there's no shortcut to get to that summary. Why don't you give it a try, Stuart?
I'll try. I wrote one. I try to be short-ish. Shortcuts looks at the purposeful and random ways that 24 Los Angeles residents connect over the course of an extended weekend. At the center of this ensemble is Casey Finnegan, a schoolboy who is run down crossing the street the day before his 8th birthday. Initially, the child seems fine, and Casey's mother, played by Andie MacDowell, puts her son to bed without professional medical care. And Casey slips into a coma, gets hospitalized, and eventually dies, causing MacDowell to feel guilt and sadness that only compounds with fear when a mysterious man starts leaving threatening messages about Casey on her answering machine. At the same time that's going on, Casey's dad, played by Bruce Davison, is flooded with memories about his own childhood car accident and hospitalization because he's had to reconnect with his long-estranged father, Jack Lemmon, and they haven't seen each other for 30 years since his car accident. And other storylines keep circling this tragedy as well. Casey's inattentive doctor, played by Matthew Modine, comes home from the hospital to learn about an infidelity his painter wife Julian Moore had right before they host a dinner party with another unhappy couple in marital crisis. Ann Archer is pretty mad at Fred Ward because the outdoorsman had gone fishing the entire weekend and neglected to tell the authorities that he found a dead body until the very end of the trip. Living next door to Casey and his parents is a mentally ill cellist played by Footloose love interest Lori Singer, who turns to self-harm as her drunken mother and roommate continues to sing depressing jazz songs in a local club. Lily Tomlin is the waitress who hit Casey with her car, and she never even learns the child's fate because she's spending the entire movie fighting with alcoholic husband Tom Waits, who may have molested her daughter Lily Taylor, who is currently married to a sexual predator played by Robert Downey Jr., who is bragging about his infidelities to his sexually frustrated friend Chris Penn, who can't get laid with his wife Jennifer Jason Leigh, even though she works as a phone sex operator and talks filthy in front of their children. And if that's not enough unhappy marriages for you, sex lies and videotape star Peter Gallagher spends the weekend destroying a home he used to inhabit with ex-wife Frances McDormand while she courts multiple men, including an asshole traffic cop played by Tim Robbins, who is married to Julianne Moore's sister Madeline Stowe. Got it all? Probably not. But all these storylines reach their climax during one of California's infamous earthquakes, and it results in a couple dead bodies, some breakups, some reconciliations, and maybe just a little bit of redemption as Andie MacDowell confronts the angry caller, and he turns out to be apologetic baker Lyle Lovett, as credits roll. So Shortcuts, let's just start with the title. You could have called this lots of different things, but by calling it Shortcuts, for me, it has a couple different meanings. Obviously, the most basic is that the movie is cut together with a lot of different storylines. And so it does feel like we're always cutting away and cutting into various stories. It creates the idea we're watching one big tapestry. But I also think, you know, if you know that phrase, death by a million paper cuts, I do feel like these small little stories overall, even though in many cases they're just about little moments, they do leave a big scar. This is an unhappy film, and it kind of cuts deep at 3 hours length. It's a lot of misery all at once.
Yeah, I'm with you there with, like, these are short little stories all cut together. I was also really trying to go deep, like, okay, what does this title mean? Why is it called Shortcuts? I'm looking at people's motivations or why things are happening, and they don't really matter. Like, we'll talk about Matthew Modine and Julianne Moore having a dinner date with Fred Ward and Ann Archer. Why does that happen? Not for an important reason, just because of small talk and just being polite, you know, in society. Like, it's just an accident.
I'll offer this. There's one other possible reading I have for the title. Everyone here goes for the quick and obvious. They take a shortcut instead of doing what's right, or at least we can see that in lots of examples. If they had just taken the correct path and not try to do something more quickly or been more self-involved, maybe none of all of this would have happened. Hard to say. But yes, we have 23 or 24 characters, depending on how you want to slice it, all coming together in an opening that is really impressive. I'm thinking a lot about MASH, actually, in the way that that began with the helicopters and suicide is painless. In this case, we have crop dusters and helicopters spraying poison to kill a mayfly infestation all over the main characters and all over Los Angeles.
Yeah, when this starts, I'm like, am I in a conspiracy film with the black helicopters going? And I realize I have PTSD after this whole pandemic thing, because this whole opening about a society having to come together to stamp out something bad. Yeah, we see Tim Robbins yelling at the helicopters. They're worried about getting poisoned. Bruce Davidson is doing some kind of like Fox News commentary on KCAL 9.
I guess he's a weatherman. You could do that back then, but it does feel really extravagant.
Yeah, KCAL 9 is the local LA station. I don't think they do editorials, but maybe to get rid of the medfly, they do.
They had quarantine signs up and everything. And also, blast from the past, I completely forgot about that medfly thing back in the early 90s, but this pretty much slams us right in the middle of that. And it was like, what, half a year that they were out looking for patient zero of that medfly in LA?
Is that true?
Oh, yeah. It's always a big deal when there's some new bug that's going to eat the crops. Remember, California's got a ton of farmland, so they want to contain these bugs. But it does, like this film, just start with chaos going on. Like, you don't know what's going on with all this spraying, but it's just chaos, like the rest of this film. It's setting you up.
All right, so that's interesting, because I always took it. I mean, keep in mind, when I saw this movie, and it was only once, back in 1993, fresh out of high school, starting film school, I had never been to L.A. I didn't know anything about L.A. You could have told me anything about it. I didn't assume that this was a real L.A. problem. I took it more, there's sort of like this biblical quality. There's these plagues that are happening. This movie opens with like locusts or something is kind of what it feels like. And to end with the earthquake, to me, it just made me think about God and judgment. The idea of somebody watching all the behavior that we're about to see and maybe having to rule on it.
Definitely, I think Paul Thomas Anderson got that idea from watching this, because he goes much more biblical with his imitator, Magnolia. But yeah, there might be something to that. Having seen Magnolia, like, it does shade my reading of this, because that's the one I saw first. But yeah, there's definitely feels like some commentary about the cosmos and our place in the world.
Yeah, the flies go away. I don't think anyone ever talks about the flies again.
No, it goes away.
What I think's interesting about it is that there's this problem. And to solve the problem, what people are talking about for the rest of the movie is that they're dropping this some kind of chemical all over everyone. And are people going to be sicker from the cure than the mayflies? And I do think there's this anxiety. You see it spill out throughout the characters about if they're going to get cancer, or are the kids going to be healthy? Will the dog live? Because all of this stuff is coming down from the heavens from these crop dusters and helicopters.
Right, and that's what I was going to say, is that it's also a visual storytelling device to let us know as the audience of the class and type of people that we're going to be dealing with, because this didn't happen in Beverly Hills and the nicer neighborhoods. That was done door to door and with people in suits spraying. They weren't crop dusted in the nicer neighborhoods is what I'm saying. So it's Watts and Compton and that type of areas that...
Downey!
Yeah, we're going to spray the cattle, but, you know, the nicer neighborhoods, we're going to do it more humanely.
Yeah, this is not the L.A. that you typically see when they make movies about L.A. And I do think that is exciting now. Now that I had spent 11 years there to return to this film, it does feel more in keeping of my experience. Hollywood is a very, very small blip in what is overall a much more complicated city metropolis landscape. And so I appreciate the fact that for the most part, most of the characters aren't touched by that sense of celebrity. We do have, I think, in what I will call the main storyline, we do have the fact that, as we've already mentioned, Bruce Davison is a weatherman who is the first character we see. He's on a TV in a limo talking about these mayflies, and it will be his family that I think is, I don't know, it's the storyline I most remembered about Shortcuts. It's the first Shortcut, really, is the fact that their 8-year-old son just decides to dart across the street, literally take a shortcut to class, and walks right in front of Lily Tomlin's car.
Yeah, that was my note. We see him do that one time. Like, he didn't look both ways. He just ran across that street. He's going to get hit by a car. And then he does it again. He gets hit by a car. So I guess that's good storytelling. They set that up. Like, this little kid darting across the street. And yeah, it's not like Lily Tomlin is drunk or falling asleep. She's just driving. This kid just runs in front of her.
Like many of these scenarios, it is not easy to accuse anyone specifically as having all the blame in this.
And she tries to help the kid.
She very desperately wants, and many of the characters make this mistake, because I want you to be okay, I'm not going to be as thorough. Her shortcut is, I'm not going to insist that you go to the hospital, even though you just went down in a really hard way. And I got to say, the way it's filmed, I guess this kid is the son of a stuntman, and daddy taught him well.
I thought he was dead.
Yeah, that it's a single shot, and the way that they filmed this kid running and then going down, well done, because it'll get your hackles up to see this kid knocked down. But he does insist on getting up, and he insists that he doesn't talk to strangers. And you can see in the way that he hangs his head, he's so ashamed of the fact that he stepped in front of the car. He doesn't blame her for it. He calls her later a nice lady before he goes into his coma. That, yeah, he absorbs all of this as his own fault. And rather than go to school or go get help, he just retreats back home until he's found by Andy McDowell.
On the surface, this family is probably the closest thing we would have to a functional relationship out of all the characters. At least on the surface, it looks like the most functional. You know, they have the nicest house. They have the nuclear family. The father's on the news. She's a well-put-together housewife. I think for middle America, this would be the storyline and the family that most people would grasp onto in this movie.
It's the one that is most like the Carver story. The Carver story was called A Small Good Thing, and pretty much we follow the whole trajectory of that story. Most of the storylines, I'll reiterate, are altered for whatever reason. Either they got edited out. I guess the original cut of this movie was 6 hours long, so they've lost half of it. Who knows if there were other parts of the stories of the other characters, but we see the full story of Casey and Andy McDowell and Bruce Davidson here as it was written.
Yeah, and the reason Andy McDowell wasn't home when Casey got there, she was out getting him a birthday cake.
Yeah, set up here. And like this movie will love to do, the bakery, the jazz club, there's so many places where lots of characters interact, cross paths, and never realize it wouldn't even be important to them that they're connected. They're only connected because the camera is capturing them. But they have no idea what's going on in each other's lives. But that bakery is, yeah, where Ann Archer's clown is dropping by, and Lyle Lovett, the baker, will become important.
Yeah, I gotta say, we'll talk about how this storyline gets resolved between the baker and the Finnegans, but Lyle Lovett, like, cracks me up. Like, someone just wants to get happy birthday written on the cake. He's like, that's a whole day. No, that's not scheduled. So they do set up this guy is kind of a weirdo at the beginning, if you're paying attention, because there's all this overlapping dialogue going on. So it depends, who are you going to focus on?
You could even call that a shortcut, that again, he's just not serving the customer. I don't know, maybe I'm stretching that metaphor too much. But again, I think you can look at all the characters as, by taking the choices they do, did not make the full force effort to do the right thing. And things go badly because of it, or worse.
But even in 93, I think you knew, like, you have some kind of accident, some kind of trauma. Maybe Andy McDowell didn't realize that happened to Casey, but, like, you don't let them close their eyes and go to sleep. You got to keep them awake. Get them to that ER.
Am I wrong in this? Andy McDowell is always annoying. Maybe there's something about her. I don't know what it is.
Do you not like her accent or something?
I'm always judgmental of her. I always feel like you're doing things wrong, including sexualizing videotape. And that's what she was coming off from. She would have been a big get. I think she is given probably, again, the juiciest role here, the one that you remember, the mother whose shortcut is that, yes, you should absolutely know if someone has been concussed, you need to get them medical attention. But what you see, same thing with Lily Tomlin, is I so desperately want you to be okay that I'm going to act like you're okay. And I'm not going to actually verify whether you're okay or not. And consequently, yeah, he falls into this coma and will come out briefly, but let's just get to it. This kid will die because of it. Could he have been saved? I definitely believe that if she hadn't put him to bed and rushed him to the hospital, he'd have a better shot.
Or if Howard's doctor was there that he likes so much that happens to be gone.
Yeah, that's definitely true in the story. I will say that you get the sense that the doctor also took kind of a shortcut. And because he just couldn't imagine this being a very serious problem, you know, it's just a small concussion, it'll heal itself. The doctor in the story throughout the piece is telling the parents, don't worry, just hang out in this waiting room and eventually he'll snap out of it all the way until he dies. And so the doctor shares a lot more guilt in the storyline than Matthew Modine will in this moment.
And it's also juxtaposed with the neighboring patient who's in there from gunshot wounds, which...
drive-by shooting, freeway shootings, very popular in the 90s in LA.
A more dire situation for the doctor's attention and the staff's attention, and something that seemed like that guy wasn't going to pull through. So you can see, like you said, Stuart, shortcuts. The doctor, Matthew Modine, taking shortcuts on what seems like not that bad of a head trauma compared with a gun shooting victim, and the tables get flipped there.
Yeah. So Andy McDowell should feel awful. I mean, I think anyone, any parent that lost their kid would feel awful. And then you compound that with the idea that she did not react properly. Her husband knew, and her husband was screaming, but he was on at the TV station at the time. She's really feeling terrible when this baker all of a sudden, and this is, again, this movie could only have been made in the early 90s. No one has a cell phone, and you could prank phone call without anybody knowing who you were.
Yeah, no Star 69 yet to call him back?
Apparently not. Maybe this is the movie that inspired such a thing. But she's getting mysterious calls from someone that's reciting Mighty Casey at bat and really, really angry. And her husband made the shortcut in this case. He was home at the time that the baker was calling about why they hadn't picked up the birthday cake. And rather than say, what are you talking about, clarifying, saying we're not going to be able to do it, he just calls him an asshole and it becomes this phone war.
I'm not blaming the dad here. Like, there's trauma going on. Your kid's in the hospital in a coma. You don't have time to deal with this. I don't understand Lyle Lovett's Baker character. Like, he is so extreme. Like, this is one part of the storyline where I'm like, okay, I get, like, they want to do something showing more and more trauma caused, but it felt really out of left field. I'm like, you're not going to get a lot of repeat business if that's how you treat your customers.
I'll go a little bit more specific. I don't know that I have a problem with the character. I have a problem with kindly country and western singer Lyle Lovett trying to embody this level of disgruntledness. He feels like a puppy dog. He's not a trained actor. And, you know, Altman is famous for this. He loves to just, hence why we have Huey Lewis and other non-actors that pop up in his movies all the time. He just feels like people can be themselves in front of the camera and encourages that. Well, Lyle Lovett is the wrong match for this baker. I think this storyline is very hurt by the fact that we can't understand and get his rage about things.
Should have been Tom Waits. Tom Waits seems like an angry baker.
There you go. That's a total fix. If you had Tom Waits in this, he would be a very angry baker.
So let me ask you guys this. It sounds like both of you are kind of on the same page of laying blame at the feet of Andy McDowell's character here. And I don't think that that was inherent in the film. I feel like that's stuff you guys are bringing.
I mean, in basic first aid, yes, I was a Boy Scout, so maybe I know more than the average housewife, but I feel like someone in an accident, you don't let them go to sleep.
Blame is a tough word. I think all the characters make choices that are short of the right choice. They shortcut what they should have done, and because they made that choice, in this case, the ultimate price is paid. So, again, I don't walk away blaming anyone, or maybe I blame everyone. Again, that gets to that whole idea of God and judgment that sort of hovers over the whole movie. I don't know who's at fault, but it does feel like you're watching a lot of people make terrible decisions and hurting each other.
Yeah, Justin, I don't want her brought up on like manslaughter charges. I wouldn't go that far. But like you're saying, Stuart, you're making quick decisions that you do every day that usually no harm comes from it. And we're kind of seeing the flip side of that now.
Yeah, and I guess I just wanted to be clear for people who might not have seen this movie that it's not being played out as she has sinister intentions.
No, she feels very bad for the whole thing. She's distraught the rest of the film.
Yes, this destroys her.
Yes, and it should be said, the child doesn't die until much later in the picture. They live under the impression, her and her husband, that this child is going to snap out of it at any given moment. And again, she's more distressed by the fact that she thinks the person that hit her child, that was driving the car, might be leaving these messages on the answering machine. But before the child passed out, he said it was a kindly lady. So We know that's not Lyle Lovett, so what could all of this mean? Question for you guys. I think it was a mistake. Again, I think it was a mistake to cast Lyle Lovett as this baker, but I think it was a mistake to tell us so early who was leaving the calls. I would have preferred to have a mystery about someone sinister leaving the phone calls, rather than knowing very early into the picture that we cut to Lyle Lovett on the phone.
Like if you thought maybe it's just some pervert trying to make obscene calls and they pick someone at random, yeah.
You're looking at everyone in this cast and thinking, Robert Downey Jr., you seem sleazy enough to do this to a grieving mother. But we don't have that guessing game. Again, they cut to very early on, Lyle Lovett swigging alcohol and looking very unhappy in that chef's hat and hanging up the phone. We know who's doing it, even though she won't know who's doing it for the entire film.
Well, she does eventually figure it out. The first night they're back, she's lying in bed sleepless and comes to the conclusion that she figured it out.
Yeah, she should have figured it out much quicker.
I don't know. Because she was dealing with what she was dealing with, it's hard to know. Her mental state obviously would be frazzled and her thoughts elsewhere, but he never actually does say you didn't pick up the cake or anything either. He's just tormenting the fact that it was a baseball-themed cake, and so he's doing all these baseball... It's a weird kind of pranking, but yeah, reading Casey at bat, it's ominous to her, but not with the intent that, you know, if the baker had known, this is obviously the tragedy of the situation. If only he had known why the cake wasn't picked up, he would have probably been a lot more compassionate.
I mean, it should be said that his egregiousness is the fact that he put time and effort into making a cake that was never picked up. That's the long and short of it.
Make them put down a deposit. Problem solved.
Right. Yeah. Who makes the cake before you have the money? That was an easy fix, right? But the 90s, I'll just say maybe they didn't have that figured out yet.
Now, there's a lot of characters in this. They come and go. But I wasn't quite sure while we're at the hospital. Casey's there. The parents are there. Paul Finnegan, played by Jack Lemmon, he's the father of Bruce Davidson. He shows up, and I wasn't quite sure why.
It's a different story. And in fact, I'm just going to argue, I read this story that this is supposedly based on, and it has almost nothing to do with what I'm watching. But yes, Lemonade is one of the last things Carver ever wrote.
He made Jack Lemmon star as the character from a story called Lemonade.
I don't understand the significance of that.
Jack Lemmon, Lemonade.
Oh, yeah, okay. I did not connect that. Maybe that is why it's based on that, because that's the only thing that Lemonade connects with the story. It's about a grandfather talking about why his son can't get over the grandson dying, but entirely different ways, and nothing about an affair. What we're to see is that for Bruce Davison's character, he can't entirely be present for his own son's hospitalization because something very similar happened to him. And because they don't film flashbacks, all of this is done in monologue and unspoken subtext. But yes, what brings Jack Lemmon to the hospital is news that his grandson has been hurt in a car accident. And 30 years ago, irony of ironies, his own son was hurt in a car accident. He was not there, and he's never seen his son since. So this is really a reconciliation between father and son. I don't know. Are you buying this moment? I feel like I like Jack Lemmon. I feel like the performance is okay. The monologue is obviously full of pathos. But in the end, what I would argue about Shortcuts, the thing that trips me up about it, in many cases, the storylines themselves are not impressive. It's the way the stories come together that impress me. But the idea that this man had an affair and got caught by the wife as she was coming to tell him that his son was in the hospital doesn't feel worthy of all the time we spend on it.
Well, the problem is, this feels like it's a big moment, and I don't want to say it's resolved. Jack Lemmon just kind of leaves the hospital after giving his monologue, but I don't feel like I know enough about these characters for this monologue to mean much. This might be a cool exercise of, you know, if you're in an acting class to give this monologue, but as far as the story, and a lot of these storylines are not going to get resolved, but this one, I felt like there's a lot of information that I needed for this to be more impactful.
Yeah, I mean, from a performance standpoint, Lemmon nails it. I mean, I feel it, and I'm there with him in the story in the moment, but in service to our story, it just feels like melodrama stacking on top of a situation that's much better. I mean, at the end of the day, it's an old man unburdening himself at the worst possible time in his son's life.
Yeah, you're not supposed to like this character, right? Because I don't like... He feels like a shyster. He's getting along with that couple whose son got shot in the drive-by, and he seems very charming, but he's, yeah, kind of a despicable character.
Well, I mean, let's just call it what it is. He's not recognizing the gravity of the situation. He's using the fact that his grandson is hospitalized, hanging between life and death, and he's taking this opportunity to tell his son, it's so great that you're on TV as a weatherman. He's not acknowledging what's going on. And I guess that would mean more if I felt like in the past, he didn't go see his son because he couldn't handle those kinds of life and death stakes. But what we hear in that monologue is the idea that Jack Lemmon ultimately was banging the neighbor. And because he was banging the neighbor, his wife came home to tell him, your son's in the hospital, and she kicked him out.
Worse than that, it was his wife's sister.
Yeah, it was his wife's sister.
Yeah, you're right, you're right. For her, it was worse because you're screwing my sister. And so, again, that almost plays like comedy to me. And so it's a weird pairing to have this semi-comedic, but yeah, definitely in a different key, in a different register. This song is playing at the same time we're watching a child fight to stay alive. It is a weird match. And sometimes I do feel that the pairings of the different stories in Shortcuts aren't harmonious.
And is that necessarily a bad thing? Again, if you're trying to just show, here's real life, here's a Jackson Pollock painting splattered all over of L.A., I kind of welcome that chaos a little bit. Like, I don't want everything wrapped up because that's not how life is. But yeah, you're trying to balance maybe those more artistic endeavors with storytelling that's going to bring me in. And yeah, Jack Lemmon, okay, he's in and out of the film. I don't miss him.
Here's what I would say to that, because yes, this is where we get into the capturing life versus art. And yes, storytelling requires us, you know, we talk about it all the time, about structure and what you do in Act 1 versus Act 3 and closure and all of that. If life doesn't have that, are you a better storyteller for not including some of those beats and elements? I tend to err on the idea that I'm okay with movies and stories not feeling like life. If I wanted to watch life, I would go watch my Ring camera. You know what I mean? Like, I would just watch things pass by my door. I do want a director to direct me towards things they find important. And so that I do feel like the fact that Jack Lemmon is here should have some echo in what's going on with Bruce Davison and his own son, more than it ends up really feeling. And I do think it's a missed opportunity.
Yeah, if there was more of Davison not wanting to go to the hospital because it's bringing about the memories of his father when he was a kid in the hospital. But the fact that he's willing to go to the hospital, like, they tell this very traumatic story, but I just don't see what the impact is.
I'll put it this way. Altman chooses to underplay. When I think about Magnolia, Paul Thomas Anderson does these same beats and overplays. This, to me, feels like the moments where Tom Cruise comes to, I think, Jason Robards' deathbed.
Yes.
And they really play up the tears. So what is your preference? What would you rather have? Overstatement, opera, or would you like the idea that it's more like documentary and just little moments that disappear? I will say Carver's stories feel like little tiny moments, and so they don't feel like cinema. It's why we haven't seen too many of his stories turn into movies. They're not cinematic.
Yeah, I feel like Magnolia is very almost oppressive with how downtrodden every character is in that film. And this one, like, there are times where I'm laughing. I'm like, oh, this is just a comedy sometimes.
Interesting. Because I do feel like I feel bad when I think about most of these characters, and I don't like any of these characters.
By the end, yes.
Yeah, I feel like both of them can be depressing, but in different ways. Because Altman is not the same thing as Anderson, even though they're doing the same thing, they're playing the same song, it sounds very different.
To me, the Jack Lemmon scene, the major one, almost feels like where your entire sense of this movie is going to come down. If you're not in it for, you know, this legendary actor basically sharing a short story for us inside of this Shortcuts movie, then this whole thing could be a mess for you. This is this thesis statement of making this movie.
If this were an anthology, if this were a short that I just watched on YouTube, I would say Jack Lemmon did a really good job. The fact that it has been put and assembled and crafted to be a part of this larger tapestry of Shortcuts that have happened, I think that it needs to be more integrated. In my impression, this is one of the stories that doesn't marry as well with what's going on screen. Other than you just see very complicated relationships between parents and children throughout this. I mean, we can talk about that as we move on. Look at the neighbors. We have this mother and daughter combo that is hellacious. Probably the most unlikable characters, or at least the most unrelatable in the entire movie, are Laurie Singer and her mom, Annie Ross.
Oh, okay. Maybe this says something about me. Annie Ross, Tess Trainor, the jazz singer, this elderly jazz singer in this film. Look, my dad's side of the family, they were big band singers, my grandma and her sisters. And I saw this kind of thing, like, until they are dead in their 90s, they are going to hold on to this dream and find some dive bar to perform in and live in those big band era days. Maybe it's an LA thing, but like, this character seemed very relatable to me. Not likable, but relatable.
Okay, interesting. All right, you're right. And yeah, that's not my experience. My mother and my family have never cut a jazz record. I'm so glad. And these are made up characters. There is no Carver story that they tried to even adapt. Altman wanted a way to personify sort of the tension between the characters. And so he wanted a child character to be playing one style of music and the adult character playing another style of music. And that would be the way that that would harmonize and clash, would sort of set the jazzy tone. Because I think this movie assembles a lot like jazz. And I think that by personifying the soundtrack here with these two characters, you're getting a lot of that flavor.
Yeah, and it should be said that a lot of this music in here is original to the movie. I mean, they had, I think Elvis Costello wrote some of the songs here, and wasn't just off-the-shelf music. This was, like you said, Stuart, integral to the way this film plays.
Also worth pointing out, Annie Ross is an actual jazz singer from the 60s, and Laurie Singer, the one playing the daughter, I guess she was on Fame, the TV show, playing the cello. That was her instrument. She's really playing this music when you see her on screen.
And I really like both their music. I like the old jazz singer stuff, and I like this cello. I remember I watched the trailer for this, just, okay, let me get an idea of what I'm about to watch for the next 3 hours. And they really did play up that cello music, like almost like it's a horror movie. Just so overbearing in that trailer. But yeah, I really like this, and I get it. It's a nice way to show how they're different. One's in the jazzy stuff, one's into the classical stuff. One is playing at the dive bar. One is playing for Alex Trebek in a concert hall.
What do you think is really going on here? I made in my plot summary the accusation that may not be true that Zoe Trainor, the Laurie Singer character, is mentally ill. It looks that way to me, but perhaps she's just neglected. We definitely see her doing lots of things to try and get attention from a mother that just can't work up the effort for anything other than sad, sad songs about her own life.
And again, this is my dad and his mother's story. Now, he never, like, broke glasses to cut his flesh, but yes, the total self-absorption of this mother and ignoring her daughter, there could be mental illness there just getting magnified from that neglect.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, mental illness is tricky to diagnose for that reason, is it? Which came first kind of mentality. We do find out that the father that's no longer in the picture does some of the things that Laurie Singer will do in this movie, that he did at one point. I think he got high and cut his hand. Was that story the inspiration for her to break that glass and cut her own hand? Or are they both people that were depressive?
Yeah, we see early on when Chris Penn is spying on her skinny dipping, she likes to float face down like she's drowned, and her mother yells at her for that. So it seems like she has some fascination.
She's obsessed with death, but is that because she has mental illness and is depressive, or because she's heard stories about a father that actually committed suicide, or are these just cries for attention from a mother that is so narcissistic and cannot give it? Again, open to interpretation. I think Altman is always ambiguous and happy to have people have radically different impressions. What are your guys' impressions about what's going on?
I think you're both right. I mean, I think that just makes it more powerful because, I mean, in real life, there very seldomly is a definitive answer that this person is depressive and needs exactly this medication to be better, or they just need more attention or whatever. I mean, these type of things make it feel more real. I mean, so often in movies you see, oh, I'm depressed. Here's Zoloft. Okay, I'm better now. This isn't that. This is dirty, gritty, real life.
Whether it's mental illness or not, I do definitely think it's because of this strain with the mother. The fact that Laurie Singer is such a great cellist, with a mother who doesn't support her at all, doesn't like that style of music, seems really annoyed whenever she's practicing. She can excel. Maybe she does that because she hates her mother so much and has that fractured relationship. That's why she's played this cello.
There's an interesting moment, too, where Laurie Singer, she's bashed her hand, she bandages it up, she goes to practice with her quartet. They ask her about it, and she mentions that she doesn't think her mother has much time left and that it's a cruel disease. Is she talking about alcoholism? Is she talking about dementia? Is she talking about something else that is going on in this family? Again, so many questions, so many ways to read between the lines.
Yeah, I mean, that I kind of read as she's made up some fantasy to tell her group, make her feel more heroic.
Mm.
She's at home taking care of an invalid mother who's on her deathbed, as maybe just a way of getting attention and also keeping mom out of her personal life.
I mean, we will find out in the end that nobody in the jazz world knows that Tess has a daughter. It will be a big shock to them that there's even this adult who's, again, a very celebrated classic cellist. You'd think a mom would be proud, but there seems to be almost an intentional hiding of this identity that it begs a lot of questions. And there is no short story that you can reference. All that we know about this happens in this movie. I'll just put it this way. I just find the mom character so annoying that this one's hard for me to get wrapped up in. Even though it is an interesting mystery, I just don't like the performance. I don't like the songs. I don't like this woman at all. Tess is a really hard one. I wish she wasn't here, but I recognize her importance. It was a barrier for me personally to get into these scenes.
For the most part, this mother-daughter relationship to me reads as a mother who blames her lack of success on the fact that she raised a child, which seems like the child feels like she didn't raise her. So there's just bad blood there.
Yeah, that could very well be the reason. I would be a bigger star if I hadn't had you. Or maybe you're the reason why my husband killed himself in the first place. I mean, again, so many ways you could go.
And is it necessarily a bad thing? Now, we talked about this earlier with storytelling and film and narratives. Probably would be a bad thing that, or is it that it's so ambiguous that we're not sure that we're reading into it our own way? Is that bad storytelling? You should have worked on the script more.
I think that it is Altman's way. And I do think that if you're coming to a Robert Altman movie and expecting different, you will be perpetually unsatisfied with what the story does not convey or accomplish. I think that, again, it's all about the context. What to me becomes interesting is not so much Laurie Singer herself, but the fact that she becomes this motif that, yeah, we see her floating in the pool. And then later, we're going to see a dead body floating in the pool. And the way that these visual motifs kind of connect all the characters, again, makes me think about the ways that their stories meaningfully, or maybe randomly, thematically, have connection. So let's just talk about Chris Penn. He is the pool cleaner that connects the Casey household and the Tess household. They live next door to each other. He's cleaning both pools of all the poison that got sprayed. And his issue is, yeah, he's checking out this naked chick in the pool because he's really sexually frustrated.
And this is what I'm talking about with comedy. When you go see his home life and there's kids running around and Jennifer Jason Leigh is just doing the nastiest sex talk on the phone. She's, I'm assuming, a phone sex operator. Anderson stole that for Punch Drunk Love. There's a whole sex operator storyline there, too. But to me, I'm cracking up because, yeah, it's like, how do you not have the kids out of the room during this? How are you not in your own place? But the fact that, you know, making dinner, doing laundry, whatever, it's just a boring thing for her.
Yeah, I do think you're right. This one's funny.
Yeah, it's so pedestrian the way she treats. I mean, she might as well be selling Avon products on the phone, how casual she is about it.
Yeah, not to mention the juxtapose of, like, she's like, my panties are getting wet while she's changing diapers, you know. Like, yeah,
right.
Well, literally, I guess this is what's inspiring her talk is her doing chores and all of that, but she has a way of turning it into something that somebody would want to pay to hear. But yeah, again, I do like this tension. I do feel like Jennifer Jason Leigh is very good in this part. Where this short story comes from is but when this couple goes to the jazz club that Tess is singing at. The only part of this that's related to Carver in the story, no phone sex. It was a door-to-door vitamin salesman, I think, wisely changed to be more interesting, and that's phone sex. But we have this moment where this ex-con hits on the woman. It's a couple that needs money, Should they take that bait? Is this woman a whore? I think it's only more interesting in the idea that she does sex phone work.
Yeah, because they go to that club, the boys go out to have a smoke or whatever, and she gets propositioned a couple $100 for a blowjob in the alleyway. And like, when Chris Penn comes back, he's upset, and she's like, we could have really used that money. Has she done this before? It feels like she does this.
Mm-hmm. For him, he would very much want to have sex with his wife, and she's willing to go to a stranger for money. You can see that resentment building. I mean, this does feel like one of the more powerful storylines. It will take a while to ignite, but where it ends up and where it goes, I do think it's one of the things that I remembered. I couldn't remember the actors involved, but I definitely remembered how this ended in murder.
Yeah, I feel like we've seen Boogie Nights had a dynamic like this. William H. Macy is dealing with something like this where his wife is a porn star.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It's more explicit there, but I think it's the same dynamic. Not being able to separate the work from the person and the confusion that creates in somebody.
And I also think it's an interesting statement. And again, we're talking about L.A., and this isn't just Beverly Hills, the rich people. I think the Finnegans, McDowell, and Davison's character, they're upper class, obviously, with that cool local news station job, weatherman job. But yeah, here we see some real working class people where, again, Chris Penn is cleaning pools and she's having to do sex work. Not shaming sex work, but that's what she's doing to try to get by.
And visual motifs, again, the idea of the phone creating these problems, whether it's Lyle Lovett leaving random threatening messages, or in this case, her whispering hilariously bad sex talk and it creating this deeper and deeper rift in the relationship. I like the way that it makes me think and seeing the same things over and over again, how thematically, even though these characters will never cross paths, how thematically these stories might be meaningful to think about together. But what to make of Robert Downey Jr.? They're accompanied to this jazz club by Robert Downey Jr. as a special effects artist.
Makeup artist. He could put scars on you, make you look bloody.
Yes. This is supposedly based on the short story Neighbors about house sitting that never gets to the sexual hanky-panky that the story was about. I don't know what it means in the context of this movie.
Yeah, the whole setup for the Bushes is that they're going to watch their neighbor's apartment and water the plants, feed the fish. And yeah, I'm waiting for some moment. Like, we'll see scenes where they're hanging out there, smoking. They're not supposed to smoke in the apartment. You're waiting for that moment when the couple comes home early and they got coke and hookers everywhere, get caught. No, that storyline will never get resolved. Like, Robert Downey Jr. and Lily Taylor's storyline, like, I get how it connects by the end with Chris Penn's character, but I don't even know if they really needed to be in this. I guess you needed Lily Taylor because she's got connections to another character, but I don't even really know what their story is. Downey plays a real fun, slimy character, but not sure it goes anywhere.
Yeah, if you had to cut two people out of this movie and it wouldn't change very much of what's on screen, it would be these two. I would hate to see him go because they're both charming actors.
They're a lot of fun to watch. That's the thing. When I'm watching this and seeing all these little scenarios go about, I'm having a good time. I'm laughing at times. They're interesting characters to just watch.
Yeah, I think it becomes more problematic when you're doing what we're doing, which is I absorb this whole movie and I'm looking at the individual components. And when I look at these characters, I don't see the shortcut. Where did they make the choice that ended up causing the pain? We do hear Robert Downey Jr. telling sexually frustrated Chris Penn that he has drugged women and raped them. And there's this whole idea that he is awful to women and cheating on his wife. And his wife has something else going on where she may have been taken advantage of by her father or stepfather, Tom Waits. So there feels like there's something there, but I want to remind you, 6-hour original cut of this movie, I have to believe all of that stuff has been excised. There was a storyline to tell, and it just couldn't fit into the 3-hour final cut. There's only one or two deleted scenes on the Blu-ray. You know, at this point, probably the footage is lost. We will never know what might have been, but it's incomplete. I feel like this storyline, while the characters are amusing, they don't really have a story to tell.
It does feel like there's some sexual frigidity and sexual adventureness in this couple that is not in the film. It's on the cutting room floor if it was there ever.
And it matches some of the other marital unhappiness we'll see throughout. In thematic ways, it echoes, but again, it feels like a very small song. The fact that they're attending to fishes too, and then later fishing becomes this thing. Again, I see in so many ways the little tenuous connections, but the meat of this, it literally is not the story. They did not film the story they started to tell with the house sitting.
Literally jazzed. Here's a little improv moment. And then here's the next one and the next one.
And it should be said, Carver fans, some of the true fans of his writing, were mad about this movie because it took such liberties. Robert Altman, you know, they accused him. He didn't really adapt these stories. By combining them, you change them so much that they've lost the meaning that the reader appreciated. A valid complaint, but I also think that wouldn't bother Altman a bit. Again, he's an experimenter. He's never going to play the song straight off the page. He's going to improv. And that's why actors like to work with him. That's why he's able to get this monumental cast, is that actors find him so fun to work with because he lets them try so many things. They'll do his films for nothing just because he'll make a movie around what they want to do. But yes, eventually we find out Lily Taylor is the daughter of Lily Tomlin, and she's been important this whole time because she was the one that hit Casey.
Yeah, and Tom Waits, not the father, the father. There's going to be some story that he might have molested the daughter, but I wasn't sure if they were married or not.
Right. I couldn't even figure out whether it was stepdaughter or actual daughter. It sounded like he was a later choice for husband for Lily Tomlin, and that I'm not even sure that it was anything more than he made a pass at Lily Taylor. Again, it's very underdeveloped, and I would say too underdeveloped for me to really work very hard at figuring out what's going on.
Well, I do like the story. I agree. Like, what's the exact mechanics? I'm not sure, but this couple, Doreen and Earl, Lily Tomlin and Tom Waits, I do enjoy their story because you just see this all the time, this toxic couple, like, but we're going to get out of Downey, which sounds like a Tom Waits song, but like, he keeps promising to get her out of there because I agree, you don't want to be in Downey. Sorry to any of our listeners in Downey.
They're sorry too.
But I do find, again, a relatable relationship story. Like, this couple, like, obviously, probably shouldn't be together. Tom Waits is the alcoholic. He's always getting upset as Lily Tomlin's getting checked out by people at the diner for her ass.
Yes, that is the short story. The short story is specifically the idea that a man realizes that other men are ogling his wife's fat ass. It should be said, in the story, he took quite some shame about the way that they were talking about his wife. And then he then encouraged and manipulated and gaslighted her into losing weight so that he could take pride when those same men later complimented her ass. Again, a very different story than what we see unfold here in the movie.
And I was expecting something more explosive to happen with Tom Waits. We'll see that he won't confront anyone. These men are commenting on his wife or girlfriends, whatever, but he gets up and leaves. Later on, he's going to go to that jazz club, and these men are going to be talking loud during the performance. He has to be quiet. They threaten him. He leaves. I felt like, okay, at some point, he's got to explode, and I guess he never does. He just stays in Downey. He never gets that gumption to explode and get out of there or confront any of the people that are bothering him.
He's one of the first characters we meet. He's driving this limo around. He resents the idea that he has to chauffeur entitled people, but again, I'm not sure that this is a character that holds a whole lot of fascination for me. Tom Waits is a charming character to watch on screen, and Lily Tomlin.
It just needs to be Tom Waits.
Yeah, yeah. Tom Waits and Lily Tomlin, I'm always game to watch them break up and make up as they do in this film.
Yeah.
But I don't feel, in playing around with the way that they have, I do agree with the criticism that there isn't enough story for some of these storylines. That people end up just kind of floating through the movie rather than contributing.
And again, is that genius meta commentary on films, how we expect them to wrap everything up? Because this is an Altman film, I'm willing to give him more artistic liberty with how he's constructing it and going about it.
It does feel so fresh. It does feel alive in ways that few movies do. In the moment, things that we're watching, they do feel really fresh. The deconstructing part is where I get into the hiccups.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think the biggest piece of fruit that this particular branch has to offer us as viewers is the fact that Lily Tomlin's character is the one who hit Casey, and she felt terrible about it. And she even mentions, you know, it would ruin my life if that boy had died. And she goes on blissfully unaware of the boy's fate. She almost gets off here in a cosmic sense of she gets to go on with her life and not know.
But she gets to go on with her life with Tom Waits.
Yeah, at a mobile park in Downey.
Is that getting off, or is that your karmic punishment? You have to live with this drunk asshole you tried to kick out of the trailer, who may have molested your daughter, but in the end, you're going to keep him around. There are no happy endings here. I do feel like all of it contributes to this overwhelming sadness as we move through the characters. But we mentioned that Doreen Lily Tomlin does have her ass heckled by fishermen. This is the next storyline we can talk about in Shortcuts. One of the more memorable ones.
Oh, yeah.
I do think that this story, it has been adapted into its own movie. There was an Australian movie called Genderbend that just part and parcel took the whole idea of fishermen on a trip finding a body and the neglect they showed it having ramifications for their home life. It's rich material to explore. It's worthy of its own feature.
So that is in the short story, because I was wondering, is this like a riff on Twin Peaks to find this woman's body in the water? It feels very Laura Palmer to me.
I think a mere coincidence. This is another one that feels very close to the way that it was written. In the same way the Casey storyline pretty much follows what's on the page, this one, here's the subtle difference. The story is told from the wife's point of view, who is not a clown performer, and she's not sure if her husband might have been involved. There's an extra element of suspense in the idea that her husband may be the violent perpetrator, whereas what's interesting about this story is the wife takes it so personally to find out her husband didn't show enough attention in the situation. What's going on with her? I feel like there's a whole subtext of unexplored angst in her life that is begged by her response.
Well, I gotta say, the fisherman, Fred Ward, I guess Stuart, Justin, myself, we're doing our unofficial Fred Ward in 3-hour-plus movies retrospective with the right stuff. But Fred Ward proving he's so much more than Tremors to me. That's all I ever knew him for. And this is the most bizarre story, but I really like this one because, again, I see something human. In all the bad decisions, I see something human. I go, yeah, if I was going to be lazy that day, I could probably go along with that. So when they find this body and they're like, yeah, but we want to go fishing. That's why we're here. Let's just tie it up and we'll tell people in a couple of days it's already dead. What's the harm in that? I could see, like, if I was really into fishing, I might go agree.
Yeah, I don't know that that's a shortcut.
Yeah, it's a moral dilemma.
Yeah, it is more of a moral dilemma if you really consider the fact that these guys, I think they said it was 4 hours to hike to where they were. And this is, again, the early 90s. They don't have cell phones. They can't just call the cops. So it took a long time for them to get to their watering hole. It doesn't look like they get together that often to do this. So this is like a special fishing trip for working class guys. And they make the very salient point, as inhumane as it might seem, she's already dead. We can't save her. Should we let that tragedy interfere with this rare moment of male bonding?
What I was really worried about is maybe they'd bond more as males, because they keep going back to this body. There's one of the fishermen taking pictures of her. She's naked. They even like joke, hey guys, wouldn't it be funny if I like, you know, had sex with her? Ha ha. Really testing the waters to see maybe if they should gangbang this dead body. Like, it feels like it should go there. Like, they might take it too far. And I thought maybe that's what the wife was sensing. Like, what did you do with that body? She was worried.
Well, here's the interesting thing about that. Her husband is the only one that's showing any moral compassion towards it. He's the one that's like, well, let's at least tie it up. Which doesn't sound really kind.
No.
But again, his thought was that we don't want it to float away. We want to be able to tell the law enforcement where the body is. He's taking some initiative. It's just not with the same level of empathy that obviously his wife experiences hearing about the story. And certainly when you know the full story, it takes a long time before it comes out in the newspapers. This is a young woman that was raped and murdered. And so they're impeding a murder investigation for a fishing trip. They don't know that, but they kind of know it. And Stuart, God bless him, yeah, Fred Ward, is the one that seems to weigh most on his conscience when Buck Henry, the screenwriter, and Huey Lewis are acting like real jackasses and literally whipping out their dicks and pissing on it.
Yeah, I think everybody would need to figure out what their own personal fishing trip, in quotes, would be, where you would find yourself in this dilemma and be like, ah, geez, this is the one and only time I get to do this thing in my life. And the body's not going anywhere. The fact that it's fishing makes it a little bit easier for me to sit back and be like, well, yeah, I don't need to go fishing. We'll go find the cops and take care of this.
And I think it means something to Ann Archer, Fred Ward's wife in this film, because maybe she's a woman. We don't really know her background. We do see her possibly like almost become a victim of Tim Robbins at one point in the film. Like, did something happen to her where like being this defenseless woman takes her back to that time? We don't get any of that, but there's a lot to read into her performance. She is very hurt by this. And I think she gives a very good performance, even though it's very internal and we never know what's really underneath all of that.
And I'm very comfortable either way you want to play it. You could never tell us, and I think that's powerful, or you could have told her whole story of victimization, and that could have also worked as well. The fact that she obviously has this tragedy and yet must masquerade in a day job as a clown is just an irony. The movie makes that joke, if that's what we're calling it. She even shows up for the funeral. She's moved to go to the stranger's funeral, but she has to go in her clown car.
She took the clown off the top of the car, though.
Yeah, you're okay. Fair enough.
All the way to Bakersfield.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, the one place I don't want to be is Downey. The other one's Bakersfield.
Yeah, I don't want to be anywhere where any of these people are. Again, this is a very sad, sad movie. But for some reason, this one's maybe a bit of a stretch, but I kind of get it. I think it comes from the wife. So, yes, this clown obviously has some ambitions to be an entertainer. And she obviously talked her outdoor fisherman husband, why don't we get classical music tickets? We'll get season tickets and we'll go see Laurie Singer play cello and we'll end up sitting next to couples and maybe talk our way into dinner parties. The next story, the real mingling, the juxtaposition that's interesting here is that we have this other unhappy couple that they just happen to be sitting next to, along with Alex Trebek, early in the movie. And now their unhappy stories are going to come together for this never-ending dinner party at the end.
Maybe it's because we were young adults in the 90s. I don't know. But this feels like such a trope from the 90s of like, oh, you meet somebody and you make dinner plans. And then, you know, you see both sides of it. Neither one of them want to do this, but they still go through with it anyway.
I mean, this hasn't happened to you in real life, Justin. You got kids. You get stuck with other parents at the soccer game. Like, oh, it's awful.
Yes, no one really wants to do it, particularly given what they're going through on the night that they have to put this together. But let's just break it down. This is another one of those, they tell half the story kinds of things. On the page, it's just the beginning that the Julianne Moore character tells her husband, hey, I cheated on you with this guy 3 years ago. He ends up, has this whole wild night adventure afterwards. They chose not to film. Instead, what they've shown here is that this is Casey's doctor. The one that maybe took a shortcut in his care and is now coming home, has known throughout the movie, watching his wife and her sister kind of gossip on the telephone. He's known that there's a secret here that he wants to get to the bottom of about how his wife, a painter, is displaying her stuff in galleries.
And I gotta say, I'm sorry, Academy, you were wrong. Matthew Modine, this is who gets the nomination. Julianne Moore, give her the nomination for supporting actress as well. This is the scene that I thought was just genius when they finally discussed like what happened that night, that she made out with someone, and the way Modine is so furious and trying to restrain himself and tell me about nothingness, and yes, we're just talking as he's yelling. I just thought, brilliantly acted scene.
You feel it, and it's one of those things where, luckily, I've never been in this situation, but if you have been in this situation, it's one of these things you have to know, but at the same time, you don't want to know, you know, because it's going to change your world, yet you have to find out. So, like you said, Jacob, Matthew Modine plays every emotion in that perfectly.
And no one would ever compliment him this way again. What's interesting is, again, Matthew Modine was kind of just like a milquetoast wannabe star of the 80s at Vision Quest and a couple other things. I don't feel like he ever had much of a career, but you can recognize in a moment like this, Robert Altman as a talent, when he can really grab a forgotten actor and put him in the right part, you can see that they were much better than they got credit for being.
Yeah, and go in with the realism of a lot of this stuff. You get the weirdest frontal nudity from Julianne Moore here. Like, she's cleaning her skirt, and so she's like half naked during the middle of this argument. There's something so raw and in the moment about that. Again, brilliant scene. If you don't have 3 hours, watch this scene. It really grabbed me.
It should be said there's a lot of nudity in this movie, and none of it is sexual.
Yeah, no, I think, again, that visual motif of connecting her, the objectification of her in this moment with that dead body and yeah, Laurie Singer in the pool and all of these moments kind of blend together. But yeah, this was the scene. I remember if we were to go back and read the newspaper reviews of this movie, I feel like the male critics, what they talked about the most was that there's this amazing monologue that Julianne Moore, who was kind of a nobody at this moment, this is the movie that kind of made her, you know, at least a B-plus list actress, if not an A-list quite yet.
I mean, she'd get to play this role again in Magnolia.
Yeah, I do feel, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson took a lot from this, including his love of Julianne Moore. But I do feel that, yes, she really has, because she's naked, let's just put it what it is.
Yeah, no, there's vulnerability there.
They've contrived a reason for her to have no pants. She has to have this very vulnerable moment with her husband about how she cheated and trying to minimize all of that. Yeah, it really is a standout in the movie, and not because it's a horn dog scene. If you're here for the boobies, really there are easier ways to get that satisfied. The other thing that I think is interesting, too, is that she's an artist. And again, what's going on with her feels very similar to Chris Penn and his phone sex operator wife, in that she's always painting these nudes, and the sister that Matthew Modine clearly doesn't like is coming over, and she's nude, too, and it's like this husband, he's holding the fact that I assume he's still having sex with his wife, but he knows that she slept with somebody else. It's that tension that's going on as she's freely showing her body and others' bodies that he wants to know the intent behind all of that.
When Madeline Stowe's there naked posing for a painting, I felt like he was taking it in like, yeah, I'm getting a little revenge on that cheating wife of mine by getting to look at this other naked woman.
The crazy part is all of this drama plays out right before their dinner guests arrive.
Isn't that how it always goes, though? You're stressed, like it all just comes out before the family or friends show up.
And you can tell, too, when like people show up and they've been fighting and you're all trying to smile through it, in that they both know something's wrong. You can just watch it in the body language of how none of the couples will be in the same room with each other. They're doing everything they can to show interest in the other people and like, oh, show me upstairs. Show me the room furthest away from this asshole. I hate to say it's funny because it's kind of cringe comedy that really isn't funny. It's painful, but I do find myself laughing a lot and watching this party go south.
The fact that both couples are upset with each other, Fred Ward and Ann Archer about the dead body, and they're all four of them are going to be making like snide remarks throughout, like only the spouse would get.
And keep in mind, none of the four want this to be happening. You know, they're just going through this as a social grace because they committed to it.
Ann Archer might want it to happen, but that's it.
No. At this point, Ann Archer, look at it from her perspective. The very fish that her husband thought was more important than the dead body.
That's right.
Is now being served as the meal. So, yeah, she's choking on that. She'll end up busting out the clown outfits and everything to try and get through this one.
Yes.
A lot of alcohol is consumed.
And they'll burn that fish. They won't even get it to consume it. All that ogling and naked dead body was for nothing.
Mm-hmm. And again, visual metaphor that happens throughout this. Julianne Moore is always on the telephone. Rather than having the conversation she needs to deflate this marital tension, she's always gossiping to Madeline Stowe, who is the next storyline. Madeline Stowe is married to a cop who is both a jerk and an adulterer, and yet she's kind of amused by it. She actually says something to the effect of, I just laugh at his lies.
I mean, those lies are so bad.
Mm-hmm. I stay around. Rather than leaving him, I hang around to see how he's going to lie about why he's running out on me and the kids again.
Yeah, you know, you guys did True Lies as part of that Arnold retrospective, but it felt like that kind of moment. The lies he's got to come up with to tell her to get out of the house to go see his mistress and all that. And yeah, why he's out all night or where's the dog? Like, oh, he's just the worst lies.
Mm-hmm. The one thing she can't guess is that he's callous enough to actually make the dog disappear. And was it in the movie? I know it was in the story that the dog was given to the family. They didn't even want it. And it had become this real nuisance. And I think you see early on during the helicopter scenes that the dog is barking and creating chaos in the household.
Yeah, those kids love Susie the dog, but not Tim Robbins. Like, those kids with their mullets, like, that just tells you everything you need to know about this family.
Yes. So the dad is Tim Robbins. He was a jerk in The Player. He's even more of one here. he is going to get on his motorbike and pedal this thing far away. I'm not even sure what neighborhood it is. Huey Lewis's neighborhood. And drop that dog off for most of the movie.
Which was kinder than what I thought he was going to do. We see him go into a quarantine area. I'm like, is he going to poison the dog? Is he going to stick some of that pesticide down its throat? But no, he's just going to leave it in a new part of town.
Mm-hmm. And then tell her that, you know, he has a thing with the crack kids' leadership that, again, yeah. The whole thing is that she knows he's cheating and he just can't be honest with it. And who's he cheating with but Frances McDormand? Early role for her. I don't think she had been seen outside of Coen Brothers movies at this point.
Yeah, she's real young in this. My question, you mentioned in the plot summary that she's seen multiple men. She's definitely seeing Tim Robbins. Is she a sex worker? There's another dude that comes into town and she's like, see you later, Tim Robbins. I'm going with this dude because he looks like he's got more money. The whole situation in that home with kid, hey, go in your room while the men sneak out of the house.
I don't know if it's sex worker. I definitely think it could be gold digger. I make a distinction there. I do feel like we will see that she is divorcing. There is a for sale sign outside her door, and she's not going to be able to stay in that place anyway. She's probably looking for someone that's going to take her and her weird son. And Tim Robbins is not responsible enough.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think she probably truly does have feelings for Tim Robbins, but realistically, he's married and has his own family. But yeah, not just some dude, Jacob. That's Charles Rocket that we get to see in here in this huge cast of characters. Charles Rocket from Saturday Night Live fame.
Mm-hmm. The Moneybags guy that yes. She's going to actually end up with. Yeah, but I don't know. It would have been interesting if he had brought the dog to them. It would have been a way of connecting the storylines more. But the fact that he just dropped it off alone in a neighborhood, like had it run off, feels particularly cruel.
The connection I'm looking for is Frances McDormand and Peter Gallagher's son seems to be super into Captain Planet, getting all the toys, watching all the cartoons.
He was the only kid that was into that.
Exactly. Is it because his dad's a helicopter pilot spraying pesticide? Does he see his dad as a villain in that cartoon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting read. I didn't go that far with it. But yes, one of the people flying those planes, spraying that poison, is this guy. He's actually connected with the TV news that Bruce Davidson is at as well. Peter Gallagher is the dad. He went to the bakery to try and get something for the wife because it was her birthday. I'll just be honest. I don't care about this story. This one they could have left out because of low boil interest. I just didn't need the idea that there's this, who's Frances McDormand with? And we have these two jealous men, one of which is going to burst into his old house and destroy it.
Which again, I guess we'll talk about it when we wrap all these storylines up, but to what point? It doesn't feel like that goes anywhere with the destruction. There's a lot of times where I don't think any of these storylines really go anywhere, but sometimes I'm satisfied. Sometimes, like this one just feels like there should be a punchline. This feels like a comedy scene without a punchline.
The thing that I sense is he doesn't care about anything in this house but this grandfather's clock. And he loves this clock, loves this clock, loves this clock to the point that I think Frances McDormand thinks, whatever happens, I'm not going to be with a man that's like this. And so when Tim Robbins takes her to the diner where Lily Tomlin is serving them, and he gets her an alarm clock for a birthday gift, she's like, another clock guy? I'm out. That was the moment. We watched the moment where she said, I like this guy, but he's off the table.
I just thought it because it was a clock. Like, if you're wooing someone, you don't give them a clock unless they got a real fetish for clocks. But normally, don't give them a clock. They don't want it.
Yeah, clearly she doesn't want the clock. And that's the only thing in this house that Peter Gallagher cares about. The rest of it, he's taking chainsaws. He's destroying it. And then we get the short story, which is that, and again, it was never set up that this guy was destroying a house, but it was a squatter in a house who is suddenly visited by a door-to-door vacuum cleaner salesman offering quote-unquote free service. I don't know. This feels like a comedy bit that didn't land.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it goes in such a weird place with, hey, you want a free carpet cleaning? And then, oh, look at this mess I'm going to have to clean up. Like, okay. Yeah, you could cut this. It's silly.
Yeah, I mean, aside from her coming home and trying to immediately figure out what happened, everything's destroyed, but her carpet is in pristine, clean condition now. Kind of funny, but didn't necessarily play out visually.
Yeah. I feel of all the stories they pick, this is the one that has the least resonance with the other stories. Like, it just doesn't feel important. Yeah, it's true that it's also about cheating, a big theme here, and a little bit about time and the clock and all that, but in the end, distraction and the little kid liking Captain Planet so much. I didn't buy that for a second.
Yeah, it just feels like a little bit more like injecting a different perspective of family dynamics in here. We see the divorced couple and using the child against one another to some degree, and the child just wanting his family. He refuses to hate his dad, even though his mom is campaigning for that.
And again, visual echoes. I feel like they wanted to have another child here. Like, here's the Casey that lived, as opposed to the Casey that we're watching deteriorate at the hospital.
Wrong Casey died.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe. Yeah. But yeah, I do feel like we've talked about the different storylines, but it's really, the movie is in the way that it's blended and the way that it cuts back and forth, the jazzy way that they find maybe meaningful ways or maybe just superficial ways of bringing these things together. Sometimes it feels too clever by half. I'm going to say,
agreed.
When we zoom in on the milk, early on, the mom is trying to get Casey to drink milk, and then we cut to a television set where there's a milk commercial and all of that. Sometimes that feels forced to me. I feel like that's a little bit clumsy. But for the most part, I really do want to compliment the idea that Robert Altman, whether you like these stories or not, has done an expert job of weaving them all together so that it does feel all of one piece.
Yeah, never am I bored or disinterested during this 3-hour film. There's storylines I like more than other ones, but as it's, you said, woven together and cut and everything, I'm invested the whole 3 hours.
And just, again, how do you transition between all of that? The idea that we see Madeline Stowe laughing at her, Tim Robbins, another ridiculous lie, and then we cut to the painting her sister made, and we're able to go into that story because it's her laughing face as a painting. Again, I think some of that is really masterful. I think some of that is very helpful to bring on. I also thought that moment was maybe the one moment where we see Altman turn to the audience and say, if this movie's about anything, he has a character, Julianne Moore, talking about her art. And what she says is that her art is about seeing the responsibility that comes with seeing. And I think that is, if this movie is unified, I do think that you can see that there are characters that stumble into a situation where they feel responsible by being voyeurs and having discovered something. It was an interesting way to take a lens at what was going on in all these storylines, having that artist character talk about their art. But Casey was going to die, right? We all knew that felt baked into this. I could just sense it from the earliest scenes that this was going to be a tragic storyline. Casey was not going to come out of this coma. People were going to fail him again and again. And sure enough, he goes out at a moment right when the doctor is being rewarded for saving other lives. And Casey snaps out for a moment to give his parents some hope. He quickly falls back and it's over.
Yeah, this is shortly after Matthew Modine's character leaves. He's like, oh yeah, here's the do this just in case, but it should be fine. And that's when you know, as soon as the doctor character leaves, you know it's going to go bad.
Jack Lemmon can't handle it because he never could, and he walks out.
Yeah, just walks out of the film.
Yeah, and they come home, and they tell Lori Singer, playing basketball next door, the next-door neighbor, what's going on. I wonder, it was a character that was playing with suicidal ideation throughout the movie, breaking the glass, her father and all of that, but would she have killed herself had Casey not died? That one does feel like dominoes falling. That does feel like that tipped her.
Yeah, that totally feels connected. We saw earlier when Casey was walking home after getting hit, Lori Singer is out there playing basketball and tries to talk to him and obviously has some kind of interest in this kid and knows who he is. And yeah, I think after dealing with that mom, seeing this little child who had his whole life, her life is already kind of ruined, I guess, because of the relationship with her mom. That's what finally pushed her.
Well, the mom fails the empathy test. When she goes to tell her mom, she's like, kids, it's a crying shame. Anyway, gotta go back to the songs.
Yes.
Yep. That was the final domino.
Yeah. My instinct wouldn't be to kill myself. It would be to kill her.
Yeah.
But I can understand the despair and the idea that, again, this is a character that I identify as really struggling with some severe depression. She tips, and so she plays her last cello in the garage as the car is running, and mom finds her the next morning.
a little overdramatic. I'll say as we start to wrap things up, they get a little too dramatic for me at times. Like the fact that she's going to play that cello while she gasses herself in the garage. Okay.
It's big, but again, I think it's not too big. I'm hearing you saying that it felt a little melodramatic, but I feel like for a climax, you want something to happen, right? It wouldn't have been enough for her to go home and cut herself again, the end. It had to be something.
It was the fact that she's playing that cello as she asphyxiates herself in the garage.
Okay, yeah, maybe that's not how you would do it, yes.
But I will say, probably the biggest problem for me is not with Laurie Singer, but Andy McDowell and Bruce Davison, how they resolve the death of their son by confronting Lyle Lovett, going to Andy Bitcower, the baker.
See, this is the heart of the movie.
Yeah, I understand that.
It should be the end of the movie. In fact, I'm convinced it would be the very last scene of the movie if Lyle Lovett could act worth a damn. But he's got to be the one to change character and show compassion. This is the only moment in all of this climax where characters do the right thing, right? And anything that we're about to see, people continue to make bad choices and live selfishly, and more people get hurt. But here is a moment where somebody realizes they had done a wrong and sat these parents down and gave them some bread and tried to make amends. But it just, I blame Lyle Lovett.
You're blaming Lovett. Look, I don't have a personal issue with Andy McDowell, but I do with her performance here. Lines like, there are no more birthdays. They're just so over the top. And I don't know, maybe that's how a parent would react in this situation. It felt too crafted, too written. It didn't feel like raw emotion enough to me.
Juxtaposed with Lyle Lovett not being an actor.
Yes.
It felt melodramatic with a guy who doesn't know how to act.
That can oftentimes be the problem. I've heard this director say this, is that you'd rather have two not great performers than one good one and one bad one, because the disparities become magnified. Here's Andy McDowell going big, and here's Lyle Lovett. We're not even sure how to read his face as he's trying to find the cake and all of that. It feels like such an important moment that gets lost, and you can tell because on the Blu-ray, it's actually an extended scene. He even had more monologue, and they were just like, nah, we gotta do this man a favor and cut it down to the bare essence.
Yeah, get him the muffins and get out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know you want this moment of empathy and forgiveness and coming together when so much of this film has been about people in conflict. But yeah, the fact that, oh, sit down and have a muffin, that's going to make up for all this pain you caused by calling us and tormenting us over the phone about our dead child. I get what you're going for. It doesn't work.
Well, here's the thing. I could call out any movie that ever made you cry and make it sound really stupid by literalizing what happens on screen. It's all about how you do it. I believe this moment could work.
It could, yes.
If you had the right touch. And all I can say is that it does ring hollow for me, which is unfortunate, because I feel like all the other notes in this finale are of disaster. Again, I frame this biblically in that now we have this earthquake that's creating all of this tension and destruction and God's wrath, possibly, saying, you people suck. I smite you. And they're smiteable. I want to emphasize, I really don't like anybody. Really like them. Even though I like the performers.
Yeah, these are not people I'd want to hang out with.
No.
Yeah, they've made some bad choices. I find myself judging them. And so watching them all continue to make bad choices. None worse, really. We all knew it would end badly, but I don't know that I anticipated how badly it would go for Chris Penn.
Okay, this is my other big problem. Like, I have had minor complaints, but that baker scene at the end in this one, I get the sexual frustration, but Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Penn, they're going to see some, I believe they say, underage girls in the park that their families are at. And so they decide to go pursue them to have sex with them. And Chris Penn is so sexually frustrated, he needs to murder and rape one of them?
I believe the trigger seemed to be that she was taking off her shirt. Again, the nudity, what was being denied. Let's put it this way. If she had started to take off her clothes, and then he made an advance and she said, oh, wait, no, that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm just sweaty from my bike ride. I could see the man snapping. I think that's how we're to interpret this. It is the short story.
There was a little bit of this on screen of the four of them talking. Robert Downey Jr.'s character is actually getting ready to score. His game worked.
Yes, he's good at this.
Chris Penn's game was not working. And so, yeah, I think that was the point of his frustration boiling over. And yeah, I mean, it seems ridiculous, but yeah, he decided to smash her in with a rock.
Yeah. And dramatically, again, too dramatically, I look to you, Jacob. But as he's done this, Robert Downey Jr. and the other woman come running back. And then there's an earthquake. So there's some kind of confusion. Even though they saw it in their mind, maybe they can tell themselves that this was just an accident that happened due to falling rocks. And when we hear it reported on later, that is how it's described.
Yeah, that's the irony, that there is only one death from this earthquake, from some rocks falling on this woman. That's the story that gets out. I really feared for that other woman. Like, what did Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Penn do to her to get her to go along with the story? Because it looked like they saw Chris Penn attacking her. So, like, how did they coerce her to go along with them? I'm really worried about her.
All I can tell you is from the original story, they killed her too.
That's kind of what I expected was going to happen, but then they said only one body was found.
Yeah, well, maybe it's the other one's in the bat caves.
Well, you guys had seen this before. I also wondered, are they just going to, like, loop this? Is that body going to be the young woman's body that the fishermen find? Like, is there going to be some weird time looping going on here?
Oh, wow. You're, like, Mulholland driving this. So, yes. Like, somehow this is all happening in the same time. No, I can understand why, because so many people feel more of a need to tightly bind multiple stories into one story. Crash being a perfect example of that.
Yes.
That they're not willing to have the reading that these things are disconnected. But because I knew this movie for so long, it was not my expectation.
And see, I was so worried about it becoming a Crash-type film that I was looking for those kind of connections that would be made.
Yeah, and my only thing with this ending is that I felt it would have stuck with the tone of the movie more if both of them died, Chris Penn and the girl, and nobody had seen it except for us, the viewer. And then it could have been reported as two deaths from a rock slide. But we as the viewer know that he murdered her because nothing in this movie is resolved. So why should that be resolved in a way at the very end?
There's a whole scene on the way to the park where they stop to get some photos. And we see Lily Taylor. She posed in some makeup for Robert Downey Jr. Her photos go to one of the fishermen and she gets the fisherman's photos that has pictures of the dead body. And they're like, oh, whoops, we switched photos. And then they both call the cops and report the license plate. Again, I'm waiting for some huge, big, explosive ending. Nope, play it out in your head because we don't know where it goes.
Again, I thought that was just small comedy. I didn't see that as build towards, I mean, what would that be? They both were misunderstanding the pictures. Buck Henry thought he was looking at a battered woman and she thought that this was, well, he might have been a pervert, but he didn't kill that woman.
And the fact that there was an earthquake soon after this, cops aren't going to give that any priority. They got earthquake stuff to deal with now.
Yeah. There's nothing criminal about, I guess that's the question. Was there anything really criminal about this? There feels like there were bad moral choices, but criminal? No, I don't think Buck Henry was criminal for taking the photo.
And that's when you say this earthquake is like judgment from God. I don't see it all as bad news for everyone. We see Tim Robbins. He's this heroic father again, like, stand in the doorway, kids, doing this pose. You know, he's finally having sex again with his wife. They've kind of reconciliated. Same with Lily Tomlin and Tom Waits. They might be self-deluded, but it seems like the earthquakes brought them together.
I guess what I would emphasize with that, in the reconciliations, there's more pain. So the wife, Madeline Stowe, early on said, I know that he's going to come back to me. That's why I'm not freaking out about him having this affair. It is for Tim Robbins to find out that Frances McDormand's too good for him, basically, that he really thought he had a chance with this, and in spying on her house and all of that, when he realizes that that future is not going to happen, he should have bought a better gift than the alarm clock, he has to go get that dog again and live that life that clearly frustrates him, and the pattern will continue, right? This is not a man that has learned a lesson. This is a man that has been cuckolded and forced to drag himself home with his tail between his legs, but he'll be out tomorrow soliciting more sex from women.
Yeah.
And Lily Tomlin, again, I want for her better than Tom Waits.
She'd never get out of Downey.
Yeah. She is never getting out of Downey. And I don't think this dinner party's ever ending either. They've broken out Jeopardy, bringing back the Alex Trebek connections.
Yes.
It's the morning. They're squeezing lemons.
I was wondering, did some weird wife swapping going on? They're all painted as clowns. That party got real weird.
Again, my sense is that they didn't want to be there, but breaking it up and going home means being with the people they really didn't want to talk to.
Yeah.
So it's easier to talk to these practical strangers than it is to face what had gotten exposed moments before in those relationships of infidelity. And
I mean, it's funny because Fred Ward is kind of admitting about the body to Matthew Modine. And like Matthew Modine is like, what are you telling me? Like, yeah, they're trying to find friends where these friendships are not meant to be.
But they close out with Tess singing another one of her wonderful songs, Prisoner of Life, as Stormy is telling the TV audience how lucky they are to be alive in Los Angeles. And so as they pan to the city, again, I feel oftentimes these kinds of movies are supposed to be reflective of a location. We just saw the world of Los Angeles. I don't know. We saw the world of Portland, Oregon transposed onto a certain part of Los Angeles. Is this a good LA movie?
Having grown up in the LA area my whole life, living here most of my life, I do feel like I have a very different perspective of LA. You probably have one, Stuart, because you lived here for over a decade, than what people imagine LA is like. It's a very dirty, rundown, spread out city. I feel like this is what LA is like, but that's not what people imagine because they see Hollywood movies.
Yeah, and there was a lot of shooting locations, but there wasn't a lot of outdoor establishing locations. It was a lot of neighborhoods and living rooms.
Anonymous places, yeah. It feels like a part of the despair is that we didn't see any of the sites that people normally would take a picture of when they go to Los Angeles. All right, well, let's find out then. Is this a good LA movie? Is this a good Robert Altman movie? Justin, Jacob, do you recommend Shortcuts? Justin.
As hard as it is to sit here and try to dissect this film and talk about it in a way that makes sense, I have nothing but sympathy for the marketing team that had to try to throw together 30-second TV spots to promote this film. The Blu-ray has some of these, and man, oh man, they missed the mark. You know, they were trying to sell it somewhat as a comedy, and they're trying to sell it somewhat as a soap opera, but I think the only one that really worked was basically somebody's voiceover selling, hey, Robert Altman's new film, as they showed the names of everybody in the cast over the title of Shortcuts. Because I think that's probably the only way to try to get the message across of what you might go sit down and see in 1993 if you're buying a ticket for this movie. Because it is dense. It's a dense movie that feels like it might be wandering and you might want to be making connections all over the place that might not necessarily turn into anything. So it can be frustrating, but that's Robert Altman. That's what you're signing up for when you sit down to watch an Altman film. So in that sense, I think it's a good watch if you're into Altman stuff. And it also feels like a nice little time capsule of the early 90s. I mean, there's so much smoking, casual smoking going on in this movie that, you know, back then you wouldn't even notice. But now it sticks out like a sore thumb. They're smoking everywhere in front of kids.
You could still smoke in restaurants back then.
Yeah, I mean, they had to tell Jack Lemmon's character that he couldn't smoke in the hospital, and he seemed a little off-put by that, you know? So, but yeah, I mean, is this Robert Altman's best film? That's hard to say. I think it's maybe one of his more ambitious films, and it might be his last great film. I might say that, even though he continued to work for, you know, another 13 years after this until his death, but I would say if it's something in your wheelhouse that you've been interested in, just never took the time to watch, yeah, it's worth a watch. If you're looking for a mystery or some bombastic popcorn movie, this is not that. This is a slice of life movie that drops you into situations and characters and asks you just to experience it, not necessarily follow it, not necessarily love it, or even get interacting with the characters. So if that's something you can get into, then yeah, I say go for it. It's something that I could see myself watching again in years to come, just to see how my perspective changes. So yeah, for me, it's a recommend.
Jacob?
Like we said, as we discussed this film, it's not when you really want to dissect storyline by storyline. It's like looking at a Jackson Pollock painting and going, oh, let's criticize each splatter on this canvas. You step back, you take the whole thing in, and I feel like that is the nature of this film. So yes, as we zoom in and oh, I don't know about this storyline or that one. But in the moment, as I'm watching this, as I'm taking it all in, like you said, Justin, it's a Robert Altman film. It's an art film. My fear was that it was going to be like Babel or Crash and, oh, we're all interconnected. Maybe it's saying that in some grand scheme, but it's just, here's a bunch of people. in a city, in our society, and how they might come together, how they might interact, how they might not. Just this tapestry of a place and a time. And that's outside of criticizing narrative and character arcs and all of that. So I think for what Altman has created, this is very good. Again, 3 hours long, I was there for it. Never bored, taking it all in. Again, going through a lot of emotions, very tense times with Matthew Modine and Julianne Moore, then funny times where I'm laughing, and really gross times, like whenever Robert Downey Jr.'s on the screen talking about all his antics. So, yeah, I think if you listen to this, you know what kind of movie this is, and if that's for you or not. I would recommend this. Sometimes you got to challenge yourself, and I like the fact that it's just about the chaos and randomness of life, and again, the splatter tapestry all over the city of L.A., except maybe Lyle Lovett satisfied with most of the acting in this, which is a positive when you have such a big cast. Like, you want everyone firing and performing well. So as an experience and for what this film is, you got to take it for how it's presenting itself. But yeah, it's a very, very good film. Best film of the 90s. I don't know if I'm willing to go there. Maybe most underrated film of the 90s. Maybe I could give it that slot. But yeah, strong recommend for Shortcuts.
Yeah, and I really agree with you and what Justin's saying, what our patron Simon Brennan said. What I can really get behind is this is a great example of Robert Altman filmmaking. Here's this guy who defied convention, made his own path in how you can tell movies in really unique ways. And at 60-something years old, he's ambitiously weaved all these characters and their tragedies together in a way that commands attention. I find myself absorbed in the material, how it's put together. I think that it is a great representation of Robert Altman's work, which is not to say that I think it is his best film or a great movie, or even like a great movie about Los Angeles. Because again, it doesn't even feel like it is about LA. It feels like it was about this writer's stories, and then they had these actors kind of change it and do what they want, and it became, well, I don't know, very impressionistic. And so what holds me back on this one, as much as I would love to throw my arms around it and say masterpiece, because it's so masterfully put together, I don't think it's a masterpiece because our favorite movies kind of reflect beliefs we hold about the world. I like movies that crystallize thoughts I have about the way things are. And here, I really do kind of struggle with the cynicism. I really do feel like not everyone's so horrible. Not everyone makes bad choices all the time that kills children. And
are you judging me, Stuart? Is there going to be an earthquake in a hit? Because I do buy into that cynicism.
Again, I'm a pretty cynical guy, but I do think that you don't want to be monochromatic with that. I don't believe everything is awful all the time. And this movie is just a near masterpiece because for 2 hours, I feel like Altman is playing jazz and juggling all of this stuff. And I really am intrigued with where it's all going. And in the finale, he gets kind of lazy. I feel like you might like the ambiguity that it leaves you with, but I feel like it's kind of unfairly misanthropic and just not true that all these characters would be so disappointingly self-absorbed and seemingly incapable of doing what is right. And again, this might have been fixed if they had gotten that Lyle Lovett moment right, because I think that was the one moment that was meant to change the tone and make you think, oh, people aren't all bad, but Lyle Lovett is all bad.
No one wants his muffins.
Yeah. The truth is, some of these storylines just in the context don't work particularly well. They work as part of the ensemble, but they're not isolated on their own great stories that are being told. And so I think that it is a very interesting tapestry. It is an impressive feat of adaptation. But I'm not a huge Carver fan, having read the stories, and I'm just going to say this falls a little short on compassion for me in order for me to say anything more than solid recommend. I'd like to call it a high recommend for its production. For Robert Altman, it is certainly a high point in his career. I think if you're interested in films from the 1990s, this is one to see. It's an important 90s film, but yeah, I wouldn't say that I love it. I would say that it's a solid recommend and better than Popeye. I think we can all agree on that.
Uwe Boll might even get some recommends if that's our bar.
But I do think, you know, and you say, was it his last good film? I don't know. Cookie's Fortune, there were ones that people liked. They were smaller films. They were duds. The one he made right after this one had really big stars and it really stunk up the screen. prêt-à-porter, ready to wear. It was about the fashion industry, Julia Roberts. If you haven't seen it, don't bother, but he tried to do the same thing.
You had stopped me with Julia Roberts.
Yeah, no, I wasn't saying it's his last good film. I'm saying it's his last great film.
The one pushback you might get is Gosford Park. That was nominated for Best Picture. Believe it or not, that was Robert Altman. It feels like one of those British things, which is, I think, why people were so impressed.
Yeah, that blew me away when I saw that on his IMDb, because that's a mm-hmm. movie I never want to see, and I can't believe he did it.
Yeah, no, it won Best Screenplay, and it was up for many, many big awards, and I remember it being good. Hazy memories. Maybe we'll revisit it sometime. I don't know when we'll get back to Altman. I know that, patrons, we have a treat for you for the holidays. What better film to celebrate all this Arnold Schwarzenegger love we've had than Jingle All the Way? For December, we're covering an Arnold movie I've never seen or wanted to, in which he tries to get his child a toy from Sinbad.
A toy which they brought back out recently, by the way. You can go out to Walmart and buy that toy.
Really?
Is it now a Super 7 reaction figure? They fully vintageized it?
Yeah, it's vintage, and it looks like the actual toy from the movie back in the day, so.
Do people have love for this? Arnie was very excited he will be there for this.
There's no way, right? Like, I've never seen it. It looks awful.
I know that it has Darth Vader in it. I don't know if you guys are aware.
James Earl Jones?
No, Anakin.
Oh, Jake Lloyd. Okay. That Darth Vader.
Jake Lloyd is Arnold's son. Yes. Maybe this means things for people. I'll find out. I think I'm getting a lump of coal, but for December, we're offering you Jingle All the Way to kind of put a button on all this Arnold love we've been giving you. That just wrapped up. We just finished the Collateral Damage movie that pretty much polished off his professional acting career.
Man, if you're going to do a Sinbad movie, I would think it'd be his Shazam Genie movie.
Was he in that?
It doesn't exist. It's a meme.
Oh, okay.
People swear that Sinbad was in a Genie movie. He was not.
It's the Mandela effect.
Shaq was in Kazam.
Yes.
But not Sinbad.
I didn't realize. You know what? Memes? I don't see memes.
Mandela effect. That's the one people cite.
Okay. And thank you guys for joining me for this complicated, interesting, and fun discussion on a movie that I hope people seek out. And until Jingle All the Way, patrons, have a good Thanksgiving.
Thank you for listening to this Now Playing Podcast movie review.
Oh, I don't want it to be over.
We'll do it again.
When?
And to Simon Brennan, we want to express our sincere and special gratitude for his immense support of our show and for picking Shortcuts for us to review.
I came home, I told Earl our whole life could change. Earl tells me to go on a diet.
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
I say we got about 2 hours of prime trout time left, and that's what we got to deal with.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
Take what you think is yours and get out of my life.
Now Playing is edited by Santiago and Arnie.
You bake all night? I thought you made phone calls at night, you bastard.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
Don't snoop.
Why not?
You respect their privacy.
Why not snoop around with their hot fudge videos out? They're sick, like, dirty pornography. These people are creepy. They're creepy.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Venganza Media Incorporated.
The lousy painter, the one who never sold anything, Mitchell Anderson.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
Slut, I should make you get an egg. You got an egg in that refrigerator?
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
Okay, take them rubber bands off your dick.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Can I go now?
No, ma'am.
One more question.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2022. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Why don't you go get drunk and pee on Armadine's drink?
I'm gonna go get drunk. I'm gonna get drunk right now. God damn it.